The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
First, as you've been hearing, Israel's government has ratified a ceasefire with the Palestinian militant group Hamas, clearing the way to suspend hostilities in Gaza within 24 hours and free hostages who've been held in the enclave within 72 hours after that. Late yesterday, the Israeli cabinet agreed to the deal, roughly 24 hours after mediators announced an agreement to free Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. This is the first phase of Mr. Trump's 20-point initiative to end the two-year war in Gaza. Joining me to talk about this further is Tel Aviv-based Irish journalist Paul Kearns, and we'll be talking also in a few minutes to James Elder, the UNICEF spokesperson, who'll tell us about things on the ground from a humanitarian perspective. But first of all, Paul, talk to me about the reaction in Israel. Obviously, we see the families of the hostages are overjoyed that they will either get back their relatives living or perhaps the bodies of the dead.
Good morning, Pat.
Yeah, the mood is celebratory, but it's also somber. This is, of course, the week of the anniversary of the October 7 massacre. And Israelis are bracing themselves, as you say, for not just the living hostages, but for the 30 or so hostages that will come home in coffins. And the country, I guess, is exhausted after 2 years of war. Cruise missiles are still coming in from Yemen. And there's also a wider recognition that the image of the country has, you know, it's cratered, it's collapsed. Even the potential prime minister in waiting, Naftali Bennett, certainly no leftist, has said recently that Israel has become a pariah state.
Now, the question of the cabinet, we know that there are divisions within the cabinet. The extreme right would not favour this particular deal, but they voted in favour of it. It's a majority vote, I'm sure. How solid do you think that support will be?
Well, the far right, the extreme right, which are, you know, key coalition allies of Netanyahu, have always opposed any end to the war and have fantasies of annexation and colonization of Gaza, which incidentally are specifically mentioned as being excluded, as Israel is not allowed to do so in the future in the document. It's hard to say whether the government will collapse. There's an election due next year. I think Netanyahu, the expectation here already is that he might go to the country early, on the assumption that, you know, getting the remaining hostages home and then selling some sort of concept that he defeated Hamas and Hezbollah, etc. But he remains deeply unpopular and the government remains deeply unpopular.
What do people believe is the likelihood that this thing will actually last? Because when I saw the pictures, both from Khan Yunus and the pictures from Tel Aviv, it mirrored the pictures we saw in January. And that did not last long.
There's a strong belief here, and I think a strong belief around the world, that this will hold. The role of Trump, I think, is critical in all of this. He's coming, I understand, to Israel on Sunday. You know, the hostages, I think, will be released. The 2,000 or so Palestinian prisoners will also be released. There are some grey details after that, you know, the extent of who verifies the disarmament of Hamas, the line of withdrawal for Israel. But there's some strong elements in the plan, as I say, that annexation and colonization of Gaza is specifically ruled out. And that was floated in the air on the far right and with the government only a year ago. The document also specifically says there'll be no forced transfer of Palestinians from Gaza. And again, even Trump himself was floating some crazy ideas earlier this year of ethnic cleansing. So there's hope.
Now, they have to presume that Netanyahu and his cohorts will adhere to the deal. And we saw how quickly they managed to breach the ceasefire back in January. What do Israelis believe Trump has in terms of his coercive control of Netanyahu in this particular situation?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, obviously, the military side, the financial support, the military backing for Israel, the guarantee diplomatically on the world stage, they're all powerful cards that Trump has and has played. Trump is relatively popular here across the political spectrum because they believe he's holding Netanyahu to account. So there's a strong belief in Israel that Netanyahu will have to agree to what Trump wants. And there's a, I think there's an international recognition that Trump wants this to end.
So the future for Netanyahu, I mean, in the short term, he stays, but the horizon possibly looks a little bleaker to him after the 20-point plan from Trump than it did before. And he is, of course, an internationally wanted war criminal. He's been indicted as such. He would have to still be convicted. So what lies ahead for him?
Well, as I say, there's an election next year. He certainly sees himself as capable of winning that. There's a possibility he might come call an election early. But as I said, he remains deeply unpopular, widely in Israel, and so does the government. So he would lose that. I mean, the plan specifically says a credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood has to be outlined or agreed. Netanyahu and this government are fiercely opposed to a two-state solution. This government is not going to agree to the implementation practically of a two-state solution. And I don't think the next one will either. While that's very important in the document, it could be used against him by the far right. He'll be under pressure from those in the far right who oppose this. But I think that, the majority of Israelis are supportive. The majority of Israelis wants the war to end. And the majority of Israelis want Netanyahu gone.
Now, he has spoken to the nation. How is he characterizing what's gone on? I mean, we heard in my opening him thanking President Trump. Couldn't have happened without President Trump's intervention and so on and so forth. Is he characterizing it as a victory for Israel?
Well, he would do nothing else, would he? I mean, he is the prime minister and he's been prime minister for so long. So he is characterized as a victory. He's characterizing it as a Trump victory in particular. I mean, he's well conscious of Trump's power and the United States' power over Israel. And, the release of the remaining hostages, despite the fact of 2 years of devastation and the deaths of so many. And he is held responsible for October the 7th itself. But there's a feeling as time has gone on that he himself feels that the war has had to come to an end. And as I said, he's facing an election and he's probably willing to take that risk to go into an election.
I'm wondering about the analysis that follows. You see, we have the euphoria at the moment of perhaps getting home 20 hostages who are still living. Of course, there are others who died between January and now, other hostages. And the questions will be raised, if you had only adhered to the deal back in January, my relatives would still be alive. Do you know what I mean? The euphoria will be replaced by a critique and analysis probably fairly quickly.
I totally agree. I mean, they're already in the Israeli media saying this. The euphoria and the emotion and the imagery will last a few days, 2 weeks at most. And then I think the reckoning will come pretty quickly. How did this happen? Why did it go on for so long? Why did so many have to die? And it's not just hostages, hundreds of soldiers, young soldiers have died in Gaza needlessly, 500 since the war broke out. So there will be lots of questions from Israelis and the media, and it's happening already. So the question is, can he deal with that in the sense of negate those accusations, or can he try and ride a wave of, victory in the sense that he will try and sell, as I said, that he has destroyed Hamas, destroyed Gaza, destroyed Hezbollah, etc.
He certainly destroyed Gaza, that's for sure. We'll be hearing from James in a moment about what is left there. The last thing is really about the intelligence failure, which has been touted about October the 7th, 2 years ago. And, the question is, how was it allowed to happen? There were allegedly warnings from Egypt. There are stories that people were stood down who should have been alert and on guard on the border. And even someone like Charlie Kirk was touting this before his murder, that he has been to Israel, he's been to the border with Gaza, and he said there's no way this could have happened in normal circumstances. I know there's a touch of the conspiracy theorists at work here, but is there much speculation in Israel about how October 7th was allowed to happen in the first place?
Well, I don't think it was allowed to happen. I don't think there's any conspiracy theories here. It's the blame game. Many people blame Netanyahu. They blame him for taking his eye off the ball in terms of the relationship with Gaza and the occupied territories. He was pursuing at that time a very divisive national policy to reforming the judiciary. And many people said that, his focus was part of the cause of this. Others say, you know, is really the IDF, the army, and the Shabak and the secret services who have failed. And there are also some terrible, sad stories that the younger watchers, as they were called, young female soldiers, had witnessed or had seen suspicious activity for weeks before the event and reported that up the food chain and were ignored. And that's also a big issue. And they were murdered.
And that's the fundamental question. Why were they ignored? Anyway, thank you very much, Paul, for bringing us an update from within Israel itself. Paul Kearns, a journalist based in Tel Aviv. Listening to that conversation, James Elder, UNICEF spokesperson. James, good morning.
Pat, good morning.
I was watching you last weekend when the deal had been outlined and the agreement had been reached between Netanyahu and Trump to do the deal. Of course, we had to have the ratification. And you were there and you were with people who'd actually been bombed after the deal was agreed. And I found that, I mean, it was heartbreaking that the gunfire, the bombing should have stopped and did not.
Well, exactly, Pat. How many unnecessary deaths of children and families have we seen? Thousands is the simple answer. And yes, it's the question from that moment a week ago on the Saturday all the way up until overnight as the bombs landed and as the drone copter, the quadcopters shot people. What possibly military objective was there at that point? I mean, it's an unavoidable question, no? Is it all about defeating an armed group or punishing an entire population? Whatever the result, the idea that we've got to 20,000 now, tens of thousands, that is, girls and boys, Palestinian girls and boys killed, Pat, over these last 2 years is, well, as a Palestinian said to me 2 days ago before this, so on Wednesday, James, we've been failed. The world has failed us. He and I were talking about hope, Pat, this great idea of hope, and he made the point, of course we hope, and it's what they hold on to. Homes destroyed, loved ones killed, often in front of them, as you know, Pat. The ability to feed your children taken away from you, ability to keep your children safe taken away. All they have is hope. Of course, it's kind of crazy that hope is a bare minimum, and yet here we are. That's why we're seeing such a cause for celebration right now.
Has there been any negotiation or indications as to when you will be allowed to do what you need to do as an aid organization for children? And we know the partner organization UNRWA will be very anxious to get working straight away and hopefully in safety. Any indication when that might happen?
Well, exactly. Look, we would hope, if you read that agreement, we want it to be in a matter of hours. I mean, this is... It's a critical situation. Certainly UNICEF is ready. We've been preparing for this for months, for winter, basically, if you will. It takes months to get supplies from all around the world and then into Gaza. The last step has obviously been the hardest with thousands of trucks on the wrong side of the border. But, I mean, we know what to do. Just take winter. You know, we're talking about, for UNICEF, winter clothing kits to every single baby under 12 months. We want to bring in 1 million blankets for every single child in Gaza. And those winter clothing kits include shoes. I was stunned by how many children don't have shoes now. Of course, they're 2 years older. Their parents have got no income. There's nothing in the market. And they've grown. So situation's critical. We, again, risk seeing a serious spike in child deaths, not just neonatal, as we did last year with hypothermia, but infants, Pat. Their immune systems are shattered, more compromised than we've ever seen, because, of course, they haven't had access to proper nutrition for years now. So you add a cold winter without adequate shelter, without adequate clothing, that's lethal. So we've been focusing very much on tarpaulins, tents and winter clothing, and it's ready to go.
Now, you're just back from Gaza. You left Gaza last evening. I've only seen what I've seen on television of the destruction there, and it's hard to know what is left standing anywhere in the cities and towns. Can you give us some sense of the task ahead? Because, you know, tarpaulins are only going to last for so long and only provide a limited amount of protection. People do need homes.
Yeah, spot on. And for it was more than a year ago that I really dwelt on homes. Like I stood in rubble after rubble of people's homes, and I got to know Palestinians. So I'd meet them and I'd understand middle class people who saved like anyone else, you know, your listeners in Ireland saved for 10, 20 years and built the family home and gone in a second, and dozens and dozens and dozens. I met these people. I met, you know, proud middle-aged men or grandparents in tears because of this. And now 4 out of 5 homes damaged or destroyed. And I had some hope, Pat, in terms of that rebuilding when I was there in June, because I stayed in Gaza City for the first time, not just went through it, stayed there, and I stood on a high rise and I saw just how much infrastructure, just how much towers were still there. But this past month, I mean, Israel's been using personnel carriers packed with explosives to destroy tower blocks. So, you know, the rubble, that they're designed in a way that the rubble from the building becomes part of the explosion. So, look, I don't have the expertise to know. It's immense. It is apocalyptic. I know that language sounds very severe. I've never been anywhere, and I've had colleagues who are in Syria who've never looked 360 degrees, and all you see is grey, ashen rubble. But Palestinians, engineers, you know, computer scientists, it's a highly educated society. That too, education's been under attack. All the more reason, if it is to rebuild, this has to be meaningful peace now.
Now, families have been broken by this. I mean, they've lost extended family, aunts, uncles, grandmothers, grandfathers, as well as the children. So the children may well be orphaned or bereft. And those who died, they will be mourned, of course, forever by their families. But then there are those who are injured, those who have lost a limb, those who have been critically injured by Israeli ordnance. And what of them? Because they will need, you know, a huge amount of medical assistance to live any kind of a decent life. I think we may have lost James. James, are you there? We'll just attempt to reconnect, but if not, I think James has outlined very successfully the kind of challenges that face his organization, and then beyond that, the rebuilding and who's going to pay for it. Some of the texts coming in: Peace Prize for Donald Trump, the man who renamed his Department of Defense the Department of War. Next thing you'll be telling me that Alfred Nobel invented dynamite. Give us a break. Well, that's, in fact, what he gets credit for. Let me read you a little bit from Nobel's will. He said that the Peace Award should go to the person who has done the most or the best work for fraternity between nations, for the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and for the holding and promotion of peace congresses. So that's what the brief is. Certainly Donald Trump does not fit into that particular characterization. Anyway, James is back. James, sorry, we lost you there. The question then is, the work begins, but in parallel, I was talking about the children who've been maimed, who've been wounded, who've lost limbs, and the kind of medical care they are going to need going forward.
Well, exactly, Pat. And one of the great frustrations, one of the other things UNICEF is ready to get in, is thousands and thousands of assistive devices, wheelchairs and crutches. How on earth can there be justification for those who've been banned for such a long time? So that's those children, more than 10,000 who have life-changing injuries. And just again, just there's a level of support that we, I mean, we've done it before, but not on this scale. And to give you a simple case, because I met her, she's front of my memory, Pat, a 17-year-old girl, Sarita. And I met her a few days ago in Al-Aqsa Hospital, just her and her brother now. Now, her little brother, he was on a mattress on the floor by himself, only with her. He's paralyzed one side down after the airstrike. Tried to do anything we could with him, you know, a bit of Lego and then sliding him around the floor on the mattress for anything resembling joy. It's just those two now, because 18 months ago, the family home was hit by an airstrike. And that 17-year-old girl and the little brother lost everyone, including her elder sister who was pregnant, the entire family. They moved in with her aunt and uncle and extended family. And there was an airstrike there 6 weeks ago, and that's now why her little brother's injured. The level of care they need, the physical care, the home, the extended family, the trauma. So as you and I have spoken before, Pat, we're in uncharted territory when it comes to mental health of children. I've spoken to so many child psychologists, and they don't have an answer. But the best is one child psychologist who said to me before the last ceasefire how worried she is that when a ceasefire happens and when those families go home, if they go and sit on the rubble, if they get to ponder and reflect upon what they've lost in loved ones, that's when trauma hits. And that's what we saw last ceasefire. We'll see it again. We need sustained peace, and then we can start to address it. Probably starts in the classroom, to be honest, Pat.
Now, hopefully your people will be able to get in very quickly, as you say, within hours. And you've got to keep them well and safe. If they're not healthy, if they're not fit, you know, they won't be able to do the kind of work that will be required over the coming months. But there's another element to this which will only become apparent in the coming weeks, probably, and that's unexploded ordnance, which will be in the rubble. There's no doubt, no matter how good the Israeli technology is, there will be that problem. And it makes life very dangerous and difficult for people going in to help.
Oh, it really does. Hugely so. And as you've seen, I mean, it's been absolutely extraordinary, just the sheer weight of munitions dropped on Gaza. Historical precedents, like all the horrific precedents that Palestinians have endured here. I mean, there's data that they believe that might be as much as 1 in 10 of all those bombs fired into Gaza didn't go off. So when you start to then get bulldozers into that rubble, that becomes very, very dangerous. Already UNICEF does a lot of what we call mine risk action for children in camps, anywhere where we can possibly reach them to explain to them if they're going through rubble looking for old shoes or something when they return, there are real risks for them there, real risks. I mean, UNICEF, we had it recently, Pat. We were trying to get incubators from the north in Gaza City from a hospital forced to evacuate so we could get those incubators to many, many babies sharing the same oxygen and ventilators in the south. And our colleagues came in front of a massive firefight, and in the end, we were 150 metres away from the hospital, but the entire road was just with boulders of rubble. So the work ahead is a little unlike anyone's taken on. I don't think Palestinians will shirk it, but my goodness, so many countries who close their eyes to this need to step up. And I would have to add, the Irish did not. The Palestinians, as you and I have spoken before, Pat, are so very, very, very patently, proudly aware of how the Irish have stood by them through this.
James Elder, spokesperson for UNICEF. James, thank you once again for joining us on the program.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.